So what do you remember from this morning's class? Try to remember something and then raise your hand. See who remembers anything. Okay, Bhagavata, Mataji. Quite wonderful, yes? Adi, what do you remember? It gives?
Blessings.
It gives blessings, yes. What else? Thank you. Raise your hand if you've never bathed in the Ganga. So what a fortunate group of devotees. Anyone remember anything else from this morning? Like the heavenly planets.
The
Saptarishis. Bharadvasa meaning. Was that in the
discussion?
Yeah, but that comes later. That's why is that true? Why is that true?
Because of the purifying effect of the Gata.
From what perspective is that true? Because the wealthy people, they will tend to get more entangled and their future is dark. So when one, and the dog is getting purified and his future is very bright because of his purification. But when you look at it from the material point of view, from the temporary point of view, who looks more fortunate? The dogs or the wealthy people? And especially if you've been to Mayapur, and all of you have, the dogs there, they don't look like they're doing very well. They look pretty, they're bigger than the Vrindavan dogs, I noticed. But they're all full of so many diseases. So just the point that things look so different when viewed from the point of view of eternity, from the point of view of this, of a 10-year bit of eternity, which we call the immediate future. Things look fully different when viewed from eternity. So when a great devotee like Prabhupada would speak, or when Krishna speaks, his words are from the point of view of eternity. Their words are from that point of view, and sometimes they don't mix with our consciousness and our point of view, because our point of view, when we consider what's a long time, especially when we're young, if you tell a young 5-year-old child that you have to wait 10 minutes for something, they can't comprehend that length of time, practically speaking. They don't have the intellectual conceptual capacity. So what is good and what is bad really should be seen from the perspective of eternity, what is favorable and what is unfavorable. So yes, the description of the different varshas has begun. And Narayani Mataji, she, in chapter 17, she read the beginning of Lord Shiva's prayers, yes? In Ilavritta Varsha. And we'll quickly go over those. And then we'll move to the next varsha. We'll complete, if Krishna allows, Lord Shiva's prayers, and then move to the next varsha. And each of the different prayers given in the different varshas, they have specific themes. Now, Lord Shiva is known as the most powerful of the gods. And there are so many persons who worship Lord Shiva. And usually, what is their purpose for worshiping him? Usually there's one out of two purposes. What's one of the purposes people usually worship Lord Shiva for?
Wealth.
I used to, when years ago when we were in Hong Kong, when the shopkeepers would open their shops, they would worship Lord Shiva, and then they would worship Lakshmi Devi, with Narayan, and then they would worship their cash register, and then the bolts of their cloth, and in this way they were hoping for a good day of business. This was their ideal, and this is what their prayers were for. And the other reason people tend to worship Lord Shiva as a means, because he is the demigod in charge of the false ego. And his worshipable deity is whom? who is in charge of the false ego. So to dissolve the false ego, people worship Lord Shiva for the purpose of merging. They don't really accept truly the existence of any demigod or god. Everything is simply an illusion, and the perfection is to merge. So to worship Lord Shiva because he is Ashutosha, he is very easily pleased. So they worship him to gain his pleasure so that they can either gain wealth generally or gain liberation. So it'll be interesting to see what Lord Shiva, this most powerful, considered the Vaishnavaram, Anyatas Shambhu, the greatest of the Vaishnavas, the greatest of the demigods, what are his prayers? Very, very interesting. We'll read the ones quickly that Narayani Mataji read. Oh my Lord, you are the only worshipable person. First thing, you are the only worshipable person, for you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the reservoir of all opulences. Your secure lotus feet are the only source of protection for all your devotees, whom you satisfy by manifesting yourself in various forms. So the devotees, as we have mentioned many times, they only look to Krishna's lotus feet for protection. They don't look anywhere else. This is the position of surrender. This is the position of a devotee. And this is how we tell how devotional we are, is when we're in a situation where there's some distress, some trouble, some difficulty. Where does our mind turn? Does it turn only and specifically focused on Krishna, or does it do what it usually does when it's not being surrendered, when it turns to anything and every emotion, but it refuses to turn to Krishna? So really, your secure lotus feet, because remember that question that... Is that Ekalavya again? No. The question that Rahugana Maharaj asked again was, what is the secure shelter? And here Lord Shiva himself is saying that your lotus feet, O Lord, the personality, Supreme Personality of Godhead, are the only source of protection for your devotees, whom you satisfy by maintaining yourself in various forms. O my Lord, you deliver your devotees from the clutches of material existence. Non-devotees, however, remain entangled in material existence by your will. Kindly accept me as your eternal servant. By Krishna's will, souls remain entangled because ultimately he's the cause of everything, cause of all causes, and by Krishna's will they are released. So kindly accept me as your eternal servant, and that I don't worry whether I'm in the material world or not, because factually if I'm serving you, that I am not in the material world at all. Because service to Krishna is the transcendental position. And therefore, Mahaprabhu plays Janmani Janmani Shvareya Bhavatad Bhakti Aitaki Tai. That I don't even care if I have to take birth or not. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, what does he pray in this regard? Huh? Even an insect, but in the house of your devotee, is quite inconceivable. If you think about it, an insect. But at least he's thinking. So how deep is his realization? At least I'll be able to hear the Krishna Katha that the devotees are speaking. And maybe I'll be able to get some of the remnants of their food even. But what an incredibly deep realization. I mean, an insect. So he continues in text 19. So his desire is to be an eternal servant. We cannot control the force of our anger. Therefore, when we look at material things, we cannot avoid feeling attraction or repulsion for them. Because Lord Shiva is carrying the totality of the inspiration of the Lord's tamagun. And one of the main results of tamagun is anger. And when the Rudras were first created, they were angry and began destroying everything. Well, he began destroying everything because he was born out of Lord Brahma's anger. So, but the Supreme Lord, so Lord Shiva is comparing himself to the Supreme Lord practically. When we look at material things, we cannot avoid attraction or repulsion for them. But the Supreme Lord is never affected in this way. Although he glances over the material world, we glance over the material world and get one reaction. When he glances over the material world for the purpose of creation, maintaining, and destroying it, he is not affected, even to the slightest degree. He is not touched. He never touches the material world. Therefore, one who desires to conquer the force of the senses must take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. Then he will be victorious. What did Lord Shiva say right there? For what purpose? The point is conquering the senses. And the implication is if we don't take shelter of the one who is completely free from the modes of material nature, even if we take shelter of Lord Shiva, what to speak of an ordinary person, we cannot become free because the implication is that there is some influence. But only one who takes shelter of Krishna can actually become free. So therefore, if one wants to become free from the forces of the senses beating one continuously, the recourse is to take shelter of Krishna. Text 20. For persons with impure vision, this is very interesting. The Supreme Lord's eyes appear like those of someone who indiscriminately drinks intoxicating beverages. So this is described also when Maharaj Prickett saw the Lord while he was in the womb. His eyes were red and rolling in his anger. Thus bewildered. So people who are bewildered see the Lord like that and think that he's intoxicated or something. So, thus bewildered, such unintelligent persons become angry at the Supreme Lord. And due to their angry mood, the Lord himself appears angry and very fearful. Now, what's interesting about that? He reciprocates. Because our mind is angry when we see him, or practically when we see the world, the world will appear angry. He'll appear angry. So what are we actually seeing? One aspect of Mayavad philosophy is that when you see there is no reality of the material world, in fact, you're imposing your own mind upon the world, and there is a truth in that. Atmavan manyate jagat. We're only seeing the projection of our mind. So when the world is appearing to us as especially... What? Huh?
False.
If the world is appearing to us as especially... Okay, I'll tell you what's in my mind. I won't make you guess. If we're seeing the world as cruel, it means there's something in our consciousness that's cruel now. If we're seeing the world as very harsh, it means there's something in our... If we're seeing it as very confusing, it means our consciousness is confusing. If we're seeing the world as a very happy place, it means our consciousness is happy. If we're seeing the world and Krishna as not loving, what does that mean? This one's easy. What does it mean? Huh? And therefore, it appears that Krishna is not loving, and therefore what should we do? We should take some steps towards loving Krishna. We should try to make some loving offerings to him. So we can always tell what's going on in our mind by just looking at how we're seeing the world. So it continues, this text, you're secure... However, this is an illusion. When the Lord appears angry and very fearful. When the wives of the serpent demon were agitated by the touch of the Lord's feet due to shyness, they could proceed no further in their worship of him. Yet the Lord remained unagitated by their touch, for he is equipoised in all circumstances. Therefore, who will not worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead? He is equal. Samoham savabhuteshu name bhakta name dvesho stinapriya ye bhajanti tumam bhaktya mayateshu sapyaham. 21. I thought that was very interesting. When we are angry, the world appears angry and Krishna appears angry. But where does the mind go from there? But what does the mind do? And then we'll know. If we see, oh, this is terrible, then there's a lack of devotion, etc. See, the world is a place of suffering, but Vishwapurna Sukhayate, that's for the materialistic person. Then you don't have any problem. And Krishna is so kind that he refuses to allow me to be satisfied in this material world. So he sends one tap on the shoulder after the next to remind me that this isn't my home. So if one sees Krishna's mercy in that, then one will be peaceful despite the very nature of the material world to be temporary and miserable. But there's the external reality, right? And there is what the mind does with that external reality, how it perceives it and how it interprets it. We see with the conceptions of our mind. We see with our mind. We don't... When we open our eyes, there's thousands of stimulus out there. When a baby opens his eyes, he sees the room, but he doesn't have the conceptual ability to interpret that as a picture. That is a picture frame, that is Govardhan Hill, that is a tree. He doesn't have that type of conceptual ability. That is the color yellow. But we do that. The child sees the same stimuli enter the eye and go to the retina, but he doesn't have the conceptual ability to place, that's the function of the intelligence, to provide different categories to place the different experiences within of the sensual data, the sense data that comes in. And then the mind says it goes in here, it accepts and rejects it from one category to the next. So if there's some suffering, there's pain. There's a difference between pain and suffering. Pain is the objective experience of what's happening. Suffering is when your mind decides it doesn't want to experience it. Then you suffer. He sees Krishna's mercy everywhere. And now, form of a distraction, so we can change the subject and go back to the verse, the text. But it's clear, isn't it? So every time I start talking, the fans turn the page, so I always lose the verses I'm on. So we're up to now 21. Anyway, I thought that was extremely interesting. Lord Shiva continues, all the great sages accept the Lord as the source of creation, maintenance, and destruction. Although he actually has nothing to do with these activities, therefore the Lord is called unlimited. Although the Lord in his incarnation is Shesha, so Ananta Shesha, unlimited. He holds all the universes on his hoods. Each universe feels no heavier than a mustard seed to him. Therefore, what person desiring perfection will not worship the Lord? So Lord Shiva is very clearly explaining in the first of the Varshas, Lavrita Varsha, who is the actual object of worship and who is the actual object of his own worship even. So the point being is that if Ananta can hold the universe upon his hood, and there are so many universes, and he perceives them as heavy as a mustard seed, which is practically five grains of sand glued together, it's nothing. So how powerful is this Lord who's completely detached? And because he's so powerful, therefore he's so worthy about taking shelter of him. But yet we don't take shelter of him. And that is our great misfortune. 22:23. From that, more about the qualities of the Lord. And remember, this is Lord Shiva speaking. From that Supreme Personality of Godhead appears Lord Brahma, whose body is made from the total material energy, the reservoir of intelligence predominated by the passionate mode of material nature. From Lord Brahma, I myself am born as a representative of false ego known as Rudra. By my own power, I create all the other demigods, the five elements, and the senses. Therefore, I worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is greater than any of us, and under whose control are situated all the demigods, material elements, and senses. Even Lord Brahma and I myself, like birds bound by a rope, only by the Lord's grace can we create, maintain, and annihilate the material world. Therefore, I offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Being. Like a bird tied with a rope, we are limited in how far and high we can fly. What we can do is limited by how much he allows us to do. But he himself is unlimited. He gives us power according to his desire and according to what he wishes us to accomplish in his service. But he himself is unlimited. The illusory energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead binds all of us conditioned souls to this material world. Therefore, without being favored by him, persons like us cannot understand how to get out of that illusory energy. It is quite a tangle, isn't it? Whatever we try, even in the process of Krishna consciousness, whatever we try to use to get out, Maya will try to flip, turn that around and use that very same thing to keep us in the material world. Maya is so tricky. So unless one is favored by him, persons like us cannot understand how to get out of that illusory energy. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto the Lord, who is the cause of creation and annihilation. And of course, he's, as Vishnu, he is the maintainer. So he is supplying the energy by which Lord Brahma creates and Lord Shiva destroys. We'll read. So, attempting Prabhupada in the beginning of the purport indicates that if we attempt to become free from illusion by our own power, that attempt itself will keep us forever in illusion. And in the second paragraph from the end, the material energy is making the universe work like a machine. What verse in the Bhagavad Gita? Maya dakshena prakriti siyate. More general. The Lord gives the living entity a particular type of mechanical body, which is more the indication of the verse that you are quoting. And the living entity must work it according to the law of fruitive activities. And that's what goes on at the beginning of a child's life. It takes so many years before the child, it takes 5 years or so at least, or 7 years, or 8 years, or 10 years, before the child figures out how to work his material body properly. And then, when the child is, the adolescent years, so the child knows how to work his body properly, but often the intelligence isn't quite in perspective yet. The mind and intelligence aren't quite in perspective yet. So it takes that long to understand till one is 16 practically for a young man before he has the conceptual abilities and the physical abilities to properly work his body and mind. So the Lord gives the living entity a particular type of mechanical body, and the living entity must work with it according to the laws of fruit of activities. Fruit of activities are described in this verse, karma pavanim mayam. The living entity is seated on a machine, the body, and according to the order of the Supreme Lord, he operates the machine. This is the secret of transmigration of the soul from one body to another. The living entity thus becomes entangled in fruit of activities in the material world, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Maya Shastanindirani Prakritistani Karsati. The living entity is struggling very hard against the six senses, which include the mind. In all the activities of creation and annihilation, the living entity is entangled in fruit of activities which are executed by the illusory energy, Maya. He is exactly like a computer handled by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The so-called there's the proof and the and all the justification we all... I wonder how big his hard drive is. The so-called scientists say that nature acts independently, but they cannot explain what nature is. Nature is nothing but a machine operated by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When one understands the operator, his problems of life are solved. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Bahunam janamanande genamamam prapadyante vasudeva savamiti samahatma sadolava. After many births and deaths, he who is actually in knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. A sane man, therefore, surrenders to the Supreme Personality of Godhead and thus gets out of the clutches of the illusory energy, Maya. So the illusion is Krishna's energy, and the recommendation of Lord Shiva is take shelter of that all-powerful Lord, who is so powerful, fully powerful. He's the one who is empowering all the greatest of the demigods. Take shelter of him. He is the master of illusion, and he holds liberation within his hand. Take shelter of him, and you have the secure shelter. The only secure shelter. So this is where the Bhagavad Gita leaves us, practically speaking, with Savadamam Pratyaja Mamekam Sharanam Braja. Take shelter of me. So is our ability to take shelter of Krishna also in his hands? Or is that in our hands, our control? Huh? Onus is on us. What else? In our hands, in the hands of the devotees. So both which? Which is the both?
Both the devotees and the Supreme Lord and the facility.
Okay. Any more? I think it's all of the above. Because they can give, but we have to take. And we can't take unless it's given. And what will cause Krishna to give us more opportunities and increase our capacity? More and more sincerity. Effort, huh? Someone said? Service, the result of the service. Our capacity has to increase. More sincerity, more service. From desire, tatra loyam apimulam ekalam. So it's as the reciprocation, as Krishna gives, we can take. As our desire increases, his tendency is to give more. As he gives more, we can take. Sometimes, Srila Jiva Goswami describes in Nectar of Devotion, Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, that Krishna, what is it, mukti dadati karichit sma na bhakti yoga, that he gives mukti, but he doesn't give bhakti so therefore easily. So bhakti is therefore sudolabha. This is exalted bhakti, especially is sudolabha. It is so rare. But it's not, Jiva Goswami explains, that he never gives it. But he holds it back from the devotees, so their desires increase, because the intensity of desire that we have will burn to ashes all the other desires, the petty material desires that sit within our heart. So unless we strongly, strongly, ever so strongly desire bhakti, then we can't actually take it on a high level. We can't actually take it because we want so many other things. Okay, let's go on to chapter 18 here. The first verse, this is the second of the varshas. Srila Sukadeva Goswami said, Badrasrava. So we knew who Lord Shiva was. And what were the relevance of Lord Shiva's prayers to the person who's speaking them, Lord Shiva? Who can tell me a relevant point?
But he's also bound.
Huh? He's saying he's bound. That? Free from anger, that that Krishna is the best, the most secure shelter, the most worshipable person, the one who can free one from illusion. So it is completely significant that Lord Shiva spoke the specific prayers that he spoke. So here, Bhadra Shrava, it is not by accident that he is the son of Dhammaraj. Who is Dhammaraj? Yamaraj, the Lord of Death. So listen to his prayers from the point of view of the person who's speaking them. He rules the tract of land known as Bhadrasva Varsha. Just as Lord Shiva worships Shankarshan and Ilavritta Varsha, Bhadrasrava, accompanied by his intimate servants and all the residents of the land, worships the plenary expansion of Vasudev, known as Hayashirsha. What does Hayashirsha mean? What is the literal meaning? Shirsha is head. Horse head, Hayagriva. Lord Hayashirsha is very dear to the devotees, and he is the director of all religious principles. So here it is. He's the director of religious principles, and one goes to Yamaraj when one breaks the principles of religion. Fixed in the topmost trance, Bhadrasrava and his associates offer their respectful obeisances to the Lord and chant the following prayers with careful pronunciation. The ruler Bhadrasrava and his intimate associates utter the following prayer. We offer our respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the reservoir of all religious principle, who cleanses the heart of the conditioned soul in this material world. Again and again we offer our respectful obeisances unto him. Why? What is the specific characteristic of the Lord that he's praising in this verse? He cleanses the heart. Cheto darpana marjanam. He cleanses the heart of all the dust. The dust is all the material desires, all the karma vasana, all the tendencies towards materialistic activities. These just sit in the heart and the mind. They're sometimes manifest, they're sometimes not manifest. They sit there, just waiting for their time. When they're cleansed means purified. So therefore, the Lord does this. He is the reservoir of religious principles, and this is the purpose of religious principles, to clean the heart. So therefore, Prabhupada in his purport, a third of the way down, says, purification is the aim of life. This life is not meant for blind indulgence and sense gratification. That's not a very popular message to preach throughout the world, in the cities, on the streets of the cities that life is not meant for sense gratification. It's not going to be met with, oh, that's the greatest thing. I've been waiting for someone to tell me that. Only the rarest of persons will react like that. In the human form, the living being must engage himself in Krishna consciousness to purify his existence. Tapo divyam putakayena sattvam shudyed. This is the instruction of King Rishabdev to his sons. In the human form of life, one must undergo all kinds of austerities to purify his existence. Yasmad brahma sokyam tvanantam. We are all seeking happiness, but because of our ignorance and foolishness, we cannot know what unobstructed happiness really is. Unobstructed is brahma sokyam tvanantam. Unobstructed happiness is called brahma sokya, spiritual happiness. Although we may get some so-called happiness in this material world, that happiness is temporary. The foolish materialist cannot understand this. And therefore, he is not only called a materialist by Prabhupada, but a foolish materialist, because it's obvious that it's temporary. And when one doesn't see that which is obvious, then one can call such a person foolish. So who needs cleansing of the heart? He's glorifying the Lord because the Lord cleanses the heart, which is the purpose of human life. So who needs that? This is what people think. They don't think they need cleansing of the heart. They think they need money. They think they need this. They think they need that. A new job, a better job, a new one of these. But who thinks I need cleansing of the heart? Who thinks you need cleansing of the heart? Yes, at least. So this is his second verse. Who needs it? Why do we need it? Alas, how wonderful it is that the foolish materialist does not heed the great danger of impending death. This is the great ruiner. Death ruins everyone's plans. It foils and ruins everyone's plans. And then what one has done, one is accountable for. So the materialist foolishly doesn't heed the danger of impending death. He knows that death will surely come, yet he's... So Prabhupada has talked about this in his purport. Will surely come, yet he is nevertheless callous and neglectful. If his father dies, he wants to enjoy his father's property. And if his son dies, he wants to enjoy his son's possessions as well. In either case, he heedlessly tries to enjoy material happiness with the acquired money. Heedlessly, without any care. I'm going to do this. Why? Because I want to. We'll read from Prabhupada's purport about half of the paragraph or a third of the paragraph. We'll begin there. Sukadev goes after the amazing activities of the materialists. Thus, Sukadev Goswami says, how wonderful are those pastimes of material happiness transacted by the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because he's the ultimate sanctioner of everything. Nothing can happen unless Krishna allows it to happen. So the things that a materialistic person will do for his material happiness, how amazing. The things that people eat, the crimes that people commit, we could go through a long and terrible list. In other words, the materialistic persons want to commit all kinds of sinful activities, but without the sanction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, no one can do anything. Why does the Supreme Personality of Godhead permit sinful activities? So this is the great questions, theological questions, why does God permit evil in this world? Because the argument goes, if he's all good, how could he let evil things go on? Perhaps he doesn't want them to go on But he can't stop them, which means that he may be all good, but he's not all powerful then. Because if he's both all powerful and all good, why would he let so many terrible, and there are so many incredibly terrible things that go on. I mean, if we would, I mean, starting with the animal slaughter and whatever, it's just, we couldn't, if we were in front of our eyes, if we were to see these things at this very moment, the things that go on, the exploitations, our hearts would break. So why? But we can't do anything about it. But Krishna can do something about it. Why doesn't he? Why does he allow it to go on? So Prabhupada continues, the Supreme Lord does not want any living being to act sinfully. And he begs him through his good conscience to refrain from sin. But when someone insists upon acting sinfully, the Supreme Lord gives him the sanction to act at his own risk. Mata smita jnanam aponam cha. No one can do anything without the sanction of the Lord. But he is so kind that when the conditioned soul persists in doing something, the Lord permits the individual soul to act at his own risk. Prabhupada told the story that he had a young son that was very, very, very active, always moving, doing things. So when he was very young, there was a fan moving, and Prabhupada was sitting with one of his friends, and the boy kept on wanting to stick his finger in the fan. And Prabhupada kept on stopping him. And he kept on trying to put his finger in the fan. And Prabhupada kept on stopping him. And then his friend said, why don't we just take out the plug? And then when the fan is moving slowly, let him put his finger in. So he did that. So they did that. They put it down so it was really slow. And then the boy was wanting to put his finger in. And he put it in and he went, poof! And he never wanted to do it again. So sometimes Krishna, like that, when we're insistent upon doing something, he allows us to do something, even though it is not his desire. It wasn't Prabhupada's desire that the boy get a shock by touching the fan. It wasn't his desire, but the boy was insisting so much that the only way to stop him, practically speaking, was to let him do as he wanted. So the conditioned living entity, no matter how humble and meek someone wants to appears, everyone is extremely determined to touch the fan of trying to enjoy materialistic sense pleasure. Someone may appear to be very good and kind or something, but everyone has this one thing in common in conditioned life, a huge false ego, which means I am the center. I want to enjoy in one form or another. So the Lord permits the individual soul to act at his own risk. So what the materialistic persons won't do, and when someone is extremely influenced by passion and extremely influenced by ignorance, he can no longer hear his conscience at all. But if there's any tinges of goodness, he can hear. Now, don't do that. I remember when I was young, I used to hear every once in a while Krishna say, don't do it. And sometimes I would listen, sometimes I wouldn't. But the older you get, and the more influenced by passion and ignorance, the less one, the passionate mind, it doesn't want to listen at all. It just wants to do what it wants to do. So Krishna doesn't interfere with that because his vision isn't, oh, the child is going to suffer for 2 minutes so much when he touches the fan. That's not his vision. His vision isn't short-term, it's long-term. Krishna sees from the point of view of eternity. And therefore, when the religionists, there are so many theistic persons who become atheistical when confronted with the horrors of this world. So many, they can't understand how God could allow such things to go on. And one of the reasons they can't understand, it's natural they can't understand, is because they can't see eternity. They can't, and if we'd see from the point of view of eternity, our vision would change. But that's Krishna's business. So therefore we accept what happens is there's some element of Krishna's mercy in it, some element of what people deserve. But not easy when confronted with so many truly horrible things in this world. Even with the tsunami that came, people were questioning, so many people, incredibly religious people, how could God let this have happened? How many people were killed by that on December 26th of last year? Anyone know how many people were killed? 450,000 perhaps? But really a high amount. But if they can't accept that God could kill 450,000 people like that, what do they think is going to... How many of the people who are alive in this world they think in 100 years are going to be still alive? He's going to kill 6 billion people like that. So if they're going to criticize him for 450,000, they might as well criticize him for each and every one of us who have a death sentence. And not only each and every one of us, every human being alive and all the human beings who will be born and all the animals. So if you want to really criticize him in an appropriate way, criticize him for that. Why just the tsunami thing? So but people have them, we don't think. And then think, well, then what's the purpose? If everyone's going to die, then what's the purpose of it all? Is it just chance? It's just it's happening because it happens? Is that the purpose of it all? Then what do you need God for? Is he so foolish that there's no purpose behind it? If there's a God, there has to be some purpose behind it. So what is it? What is the purpose of life? So then we're into a proper inquiry. Text 4. So remember, who is speaking? It's the son of Dhammaraj. O unborn one, learned Vedic scholars who are advanced in spiritual knowledge certainly know that this material world is perishable, as do other logicians and philosophers. Entranced, they realize the factual position of this world, and they preach the truth as well. Yet, even they are sometimes bewildered by your illusory energy. This is your own wonderful pastime. Therefore, I can understand that your illusory energy is very wonderful, and I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, because it's your illusory energy. If it's your energy, the possessor of the energy is obviously greater than the energy because he's the possessor of the energy. So therefore, the obeisances are being offered not to the energy but to the possessor of the energy who is greater. But it is so powerful. So he's speaking, Vajrasrava, who is the son of Yamaraj. Yamaraj has to calculate all the things that the living entities do in this world influenced by the illusory energy. So he's seen all this. So he's amazed at the power of the illusory energy. It's so wonderful, it even bewilders these learned Vedic scholars who are advanced in spiritual knowledge, who know the nature of the material world. Janiya Shunya Bishakainu. Knowingly. And even after having heard, we drink poison. How powerful this illusory energy is. But Lord Shiva has given the medicine for counteracting it. What did he say? Yeah, and take shelter of his lotus feet. Prabhupada's purport in this regard, quite interesting. We'll read from a little after the beginning of the first paragraph. A liberated soul, do you have the place? is a person who has sufficient knowledge of this material world and is therefore unattached to the bodily conception of life. But because of association with the modes of material nature for a very long time, even liberated souls sometimes become captivated by the illusory energy due to inattentiveness in the transcendental position. Therefore, Lord Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Maeva me prapadyante mayame tantarantite, only those who surrender unto me can overcome the influence of the material energy. Therefore, no one should think of himself as a liberated person immune to the influence of Maya. Everyone should very cautiously execute devotional service by rigidly following regulative principles. Thus, he will remain fixed at the lotus feet of the Lord. Otherwise, a little inattention will create havoc. We have already seen an example of this in the case of Bharat, Maharaj Bharat. Maharaj Bharat was undoubtedly a great devotee, but because he turned his attention slightly towards a small deer, he had to suffer two more births, one as a deer and another as the Brahmana Jadabharat. Afterwards, he was liberated and went back home, back to Godhead. The Lord is always prepared to excuse his devotee. But if a devotee takes advantage of the Lord's leniency and purposefully commits mistakes again and again, the Lord will certainly punish him by letting him fall down into the clutches of the illusory energy. In other words, theoretical knowledge acquired by studying the Vedas is insufficient to protect one from the clutches of Maya. One must strongly adhere to the lotus feet of the Lord in devotional service. Then one's position is secure. Huh? Be careful. Yeah? It's the message. And what does it mean to be careful? Strongly adhere to the lotus feet of the Lord in devotional service, which was the same message of Lord Shiva. This is the only way to fight with illusion. Because illusion, as we're hearing, is so powerful. So powerful. We could be fixed in devotion, and then something comes along to attract our senses, and boom, our mind just goes, rah! It grabs that, and everything is forgotten. Don't. Vishamrita. Yes, Subari Muni. O Lord, although you are completely detached from the creation, maintenance, and annihilation of this material world and are not directly affected by these activities, they are all attributed to you. Understand that sentence? We do not wonder at this, for your inconceivable energies perfectly qualify you to be the cause of all causes. You are the cause of everything in this material world. Everything has a connection with you. But you are completely aloof. You are not connected with the material world. Everything is connected with you. This is the Chinti Shakti of Krishna. Because of your inconceivable energies, Jiva Goswami has a definition of a chinti. I can't remember the Sanskrit, but it's that it can only be understood through shastra. It is inconceivable, but it can only be understood through shastra. So your relationship with the material world, the Bhagavad Gita speaks of it, the second, third cantos of the Bhagavatam speak of it. Here, we're hearing about it. We'll hear about it more because Krishna is the... we're hearing about Krishna's material energy, how wonderful it is. But he, if this is his material energy and it's so vast... and so alluring, his Maya Shakti, then how vast, powerful, and alluring is He, the possessor of all that. You are the active principle in everything. Everything. There is nothing that is active or has an essence that it is not Krishna who has placed that in that. Although you are separate from everything, thus we can realize that everything is happening because of your inconceivable energy. So, especially in Vrindavan, you see, once you hear, you get in the habit of, you say it, whether you realize it or not, it's Krishna's mercy, Krishna has done this and Krishna has done that. But this is actually the vision of a pure soul, that he sees Krishna's hand in everything. Because indeed, Krishna's hand is in everything. But one time, one devotee, when he did in Bombay, I believe it was, he did something that was a mistake. And he said, Krishna's mercy to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada said, no, it is your foolishness. So he cannot use that as an excuse. When, yes. But yet, ultimately, if we understand that, yes, I've done something foolish, and maybe some of my false ego has been chipped away, that is also Krishna's mercy. So this is what how Bhadrasva, that all this, this whole court system, this legal system of Yamaraj, where people, souls, come to him one after the next to be called an account for all the things they've done in their life. All going on, people do the most horrible things. I mean, now the capacity to do horrible things is increased so greatly. One bomb can destroy, you know, millions and millions and millions of people. And the chemical warfare and biological warfare and they've figured out how so many ingenious ways of killing people. Just think how much karma and what they do with the cows, you know, it's unspeakable practically. How they pump different chemicals in to make this milk come out, milk-like substance come out. And you know, and then they kill them, and oh, just what karma is attached to this? All for the purpose of what? Becoming happy? Are they happy? Can anyone be happy practically in this world, this crazy world? Everyone's simply full of anxiety. Is it working? But so much is going on under the power of the illusory energy. So he knows this, the son of Yamaraj. He knows this very well, the horrible things that are done due to the power of the illusory energy. And yet he's saying here, the conclusion is that this is all ultimately going on by Krishna's potency. The illusion is so powerful, but Krishna, the possessor of that illusory energy, is still more powerful. And yet, although everything goes under Maya, Dakshena Prakriti Suyate Satcharachanan, everything is going under his supervision, yet he is not responsible for everything in this material world any more than his position of the judge is responsible for the action of the criminals and their sentence being sentenced to jail. But more, he's the creator of the system too. But yet the living entities, each and every one of us have to take responsibility for our situation. And then the final verse that we'll read today, which is the final verse of Bhadrasrava's. At the end of the millennium, ignorance personified assumed the form of a demon. Ignorance personified assumed the form of a demon. stole all the Vedas and took them down to the planet of Rasatala. The Supreme Lord, however, in the form of Hayagriva, retrieved the Vedas and returned them to Lord Brahma when he begged for them. I offer my respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Lord, whose determination never fails. So who is it? What was the name of the demon? Is that Marukaitava? Does anyone know?
We have a picture in South India of Vedanta Deshika.
Vedanta, do you mean the disciple of Ramanujacharya or Madhvacharya? Oh, he would hold it. He wouldn't put it on Hayagriva's head.
No, he was...
On his own head.
There's
a different one. There's a different one. Any questions? Thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes. It's going to take me a moment to get there. 22 in the previous chapter. How is Lord Shiva doing this by his own power? But also his Shambhu, is the glance.
The glance of Shambhu.
He's the glance. Shambhu is the glance. So, yeah. So in that sense, he's the... What is it called? The efficient cause or something? Could
immediate,
be, but not.
Immediate cause.
Nimitta kara.
Efficient cause means the principle.
The intermediate
agent
cause.
Principle.
He's certainly the agent. It's Shambhu. That's all I could think of. Anyone else have any ideas?
Efficient cause means he's actually the guy who gets it done.
Not the ultimate cause.
Not the ultimate cause, but the agent by which God.
Well, that's what it seems. According to what Mataji said, seemed quite close to it. Because all that came. Sambhava, Kila, Swatejasa, Vakarikam, Tamasam, Indriyam, Srijay, Ete. You have any insights into it? Anyone else?
As a concept that he has of himself, but he's...
So therefore, Advaita Charja,
Sadashiva,
and Mahavishnu. I'll read it into here, if you want me to. So everyone can hear that way. But the problem is that translation isn't always so accurate. Srimad, quoting, so about 5:17:23 is quoted here. Vishnu is supreme, is the source of Brahma and Shiva, and is free from the modes of material nature. Srimad Bhagavatam 4:7:54 says, one who doesn't see the difference between the three lords and sees the living entity within the body attains peace. Many Puranic statements say that these three are non-different. How to reconcile these statements with the previous statement saying that Vishnu is supreme? Jiva Goswami says, Satyam. We are not propounding a difference. We have also said they are the forms of one Paramapurusha. We have explained that Shiva and Brahma have different natures and they are seen as different from Vishnu. But in creation and destruction, they are not independent of Lord Vishnu. They work with the potency of Lord Vishnu. So in that sense, they are not different from him, but we should not confuse them with Vishnu. That's why the Varaha Purana says Lord Vishnu is situated as Brahma and he becomes Lord Shiva. But he himself is situated separately as Lord Janardhana. So this also happens in when the demigods are trying to get Lord Shiva to drink the poison from the ocean of poison when it's churned. And they speak to him as if he's the Supreme Lord. So here it sounded like from this that the energy speaking from the point of view of him as Shiva, but the energy of Vishnu that's speaking through him. That's what you could say about that here. Please do not think it is our speculation to differentiate between the different levels of work, that Vishnu is supreme and Brahma and Shiva are working below him. Shastra speaks like that. There is some Shastra that says there is no difference between Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, but says that Vishnu is superior and is the source of the other two. So it's another way it can be seen. But that's one of the jobs, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, of the Madhyam Adhikara, is that to reconcile the seeming differences in Shastra. Why are they, those particular deities, worshipped in that particular Varsha? Well, he's the predominating deity of that area. So
why is the deity there?
Why is the sky blue? And it eats in that, but he's saying, why is that deity worshipped in that Varsha? You know, okay. But those kind of questions, I don't know the answer to. But if you think about it, why is anything? Yeah, why does Krishna like cows instead of goats? The flute instead of a trombone. Yes, but that's not his question. His question is, why is Matsya worshipped in that particular Varsha? Yes? And why is Mount Meru shaped like that? And why is... That's why he takes his birth there. But why is he the predominating deity of that? Which I thought was your question. Okay. Did you want to? Okay. At least we end a little early today. I've been keeping you late.